195. That's how many countries there are in the world, also co-pilot tells me. 193 UN members plus the Vatican and Palestine. Sure, some of you will argue that Taiwan, Kosovo, the Cook Islands and Niue should be on that list too, but they're not UN members, so the count, I guess, depends on who you ask. Bottom line, there are a lot of countries out there, and yet some days it feels like the world is just the US, Russia and China on an endless loop. But no. Case in point, Niue, one of those non-UN members, is one of those countries that German Foreign Minister Johann Wadephul was in contact with this week, and he's still travelling across that region. So today on Berlin Briefing, we're talking about Germany's relationships with everyone other than the Big Three, the countries that Berlin wants to engage more deeply because of the Big Three. Magic word, diversification. Energy, defence, trade, the whole package. And to dig into all of that, I've got the head of political economy, Jakob Hensing from GPPI Think Tank here with me in the studio. Thank you very much. And let's see if the line is stable because both Richard and Michaela are hopefully joining us too. Richard, I can see you there in a car on the move. And you are travelling with the German Foreign Minister, Johann Wadephul. Whereabout are you now?
Yeah, Nina, so we've just landed in the last like half hour or so in Brunei. And yeah, we're in minibuses holding at the Brunei Defense Ministry while Johann Wadephul is having a meeting with what's called Brunei's second defense minister, because the Sultan of Brunei is the top minister of everything, but he has a second minister to help him on each topic. So yeah, bear with us if we are lurching around a little bit here.
And we're hoping that the line is stable, but so far it seems okay. And Michaela Kufner is also on the move and is joining us from a trip with the German Chancellor. Michaela, where are you?
I'm in Qatar at the moment. That's the second stop after Saudi Arabia and just before Friedrich Merz heads on the United Arab Emirates. Everywhere his message is that Germany promises reliability, but nobody wants to mention the United States.
Okay, so we'll get into the details of what the German government is doing, trying to forge closer ties with countries around the world, sometimes mentioning other big players, sometimes not mentioning them. The topic of course, human rights is something that may or may not often be mentioned by the German Chancellor, where you are, Michaela. But perhaps as a curtain raiser, Jakob, since I've got you here, you're the head of political economy. We've often talked on this podcast as well about how the German economic model is no longer working. Everybody knows, you know, we used to get cheap energy from Russia, then the Chinese would buy our cars and the Americans would provide for our security. All of these pillars are very shaky, to say the least. So where do you see the German government in terms of trying to reinvent itself and find a different economic model that works?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think you've kind of basically mentioned all of the three kind of basic pillars that were kind of just taken for granted in terms of what German prosperity was underpinned by for at least the last two decades or so, right? And as you rightly said, all of those are at the very least under pressure, if not kind of completely eroded or actually sort of turned into reverse gear, right? I think especially in terms of the relationship with China, which I would probably describe as the most structural challenge to the German and European economy, like that clearly points into a completely different direction from an extraordinary degree of complementarity to sort of outright kind of competition and rivalry, right? So, I mean, fundamentally, I think we've come quite a long way over the past few years in terms of recognition of this problem. I mean, certainly both from a kind of perspective of recognizing the security challenges associated with our dependencies on different actors and in terms of recognizing the challenge to our basic export-oriented model. I do think that sort of these diversification initiatives that we're seeing here are, of course, an important element in addressing that. I mean, I will kind of stress throughout the session, I think that kind of international diversification is one side of the coin. I do think that actually strengthening the European single market and strengthening sort of the balancing of the German economy in its own right is is not only a necessary complement to that, but actually sort of the centerpiece of what the agenda should be. But nevertheless, sort of recognizing the importance of this diversification agenda is central. And I think fundamentally, we're kind of on we've seen a positive trajectory there, certainly also in terms of the developments of the last few weeks, specifically a lot of promising developments, but of course also illustrations of the challenges that this new world will hold for us and all of the difficulties and trade-offs that we will have to face in terms of engaging with all of these different actors with very diverse sets of interests, kind of sometimes diverging value orientations and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and Friedrich Merz himself has done he's covered quite a lot of miles in recent months, and he stressed the importance of forging these new strategic ties before he took off on this trip. He said he went to Brazil in October, to South Africa in November, to Japan in January. He left out his trip to India just a few weeks ago, and he said that it was the logical next step for him to go to what he called the pulsating Gulf region, Saudi Arabia, Qatar and the UAE. And let's just hear it from himself.
We need such partnerships more than ever at a time when politics is increasingly being determined by major powers. We will be better able to preserve and increase our freedom, security and prosperity in the long term if we have such partnerships. Our partners may not all share the same values and interests, but they do share the understanding that we need an order in which we trust agreements and treat each other with respect. In such a network of partnerships, we reduce unilateral dependencies, mitigate risks, and create new opportunities together for mutual benefit.
So three countries for Friedrich Merz in just 72 hours. Michaela, can you just give us an idea of what this trip is about, what he's focusing on, how the reaction is in the Gulf region to Germany coming with this clear initiative to forge stronger ties?
Yes, forging stronger ties means, in real terms, finding alternatives to the United States, because in the past, it was the U.S. who underpinned a rules-based order when it came to trade. Now the world has become so erratic that the new currency is a handshake that then counts and keeping to your word. And interestingly, that translates into all languages. That's also why we saw Friedrich Merz stress the trade agreements between India and the EU, but also the Mercosur, the Latin American countries and the European Union as a potential counterweight. Here, clearly, Merz is trying to find a counterweight to the United States, who helped the Europeans, particularly the Germans, out big time when Russia attacked Ukraine. Europe wants to wean itself off Russian energy. It is potentially falling into a new dependency. And there's a realization that the United States is, and particularly the Trump administration, is pretty happy to throw its economic weight around, also in terms of dependencies, not just on the tariff issue. And here are some potential alternatives. Qatar has some of the largest gas reserves in the world. But there was a lot of disappointment in the past with Germany, which was much more pushing or presenting itself as a values-based country that always tried to attach some conditions. For instance, I spoke to circles in the delegation who recounted how particularly Saudi Arabia and Qatar were running out of spare parts for some of their air defenses because the Germans wouldn't provide them over the conflict in Yemen. Now, it looks like much more of a realpolitik climate is setting in here, and that is something that is deeply welcomed here in the region, where particularly Mohammed bin Salman is the ruler of Saudi Arabia, considers himself a friend of Donald Trump, but at the same time, they see what's happening in the world, and there's a great need for reliable partners. And I guess in the end, that means what a multipolar world, as we've seen in so many academic papers, will in the end be about. A very different network of relationships, both strategic but economic.
You call it realpolitik. Many people would agree with you. And it is also, of course, something that is heavily criticized by the opposition here, where people are saying it's essentially a betrayal of a human rights issue because the German Chancellor is not putting these into focus that much. And we have got the reaction from the left party, and maybe we can just look at that. Chancellor Özdemir said people in the Gulf region live in great anxiety because an escalation between the US, Israel and Iran would affect them directly. Meanwhile, Merz is seeking new partners in authoritarian regimes of all places. This is a slap in the face to all those who suffer under these regimes on a daily basis. The Chancellor's deals trivialise systematic oppression and political violence. Jacob, I would like to throw this to you. Tough luck? Or is this just the new world that we're living in? Can Germany no longer afford to sort of wag its finger at other people?
Yeah. I mean, perhaps as a starting point, it is important to recognize that there was a significant deal of hypocrisy in what we kind of tend to call the rules-based international order that supposedly existed until recently, right? I mean, there have always been significant deviations from that. There has always been a strong element of interest-based policy and realpolitik in interactions between states. And so to that extent, sometimes I think it's important not to overstate the degree to which the world has changed. I think what Europeans in particular are coming to terms to or have to come to terms with is that they are increasingly operating in a world where they have significantly less leverage that was just implicit in our relationships with these countries in the past. And sort of the idea that kind of our policies and our approaches could fundamentally center around the promotion of certain values that we hold dear and that we rightly also still prioritize in interactions with countries, like that fundamental approach just has to change. And I mean, of course, the starting point in these interactions has to be kind of a recognition of the areas in which we are ourselves dependent. I mean, Europe and Germany in particular are structurally energy poor players. And that puts like that is a massive contrast specifically to the United States, to a large extent also to China, to other players in the world. And so therefore, kind of especially diversification of energy supply and just like ensuring adequate energy supply is of existential importance to our economy. And I mean, in fairness, I think in the German debate, we've also sort of seen a recognition of that almost across the board. I mean, there was a reason that you picked a quote from the left party, because yes, there has been criticism from the Green Party as well, but significantly more muted than it would have been 5 or 10 years ago, right?
This
trip would have caused a scandal. I mean, don't want to say a scandal, but it would have caused considerable controversy until quite recently. And I mean, of course, Robert Habeck's visit to Qatar in 2022 to set the tone there. And I think fundamentally
Robert Habeck from the Greens himself saying, OK, I'm sorry, I don't like it, but I do have to do deals essentially with these countries. I have no other choice, right?
On Living Planet, we've got questions.
Is anyone trying to clean up this mess?
Big questions. Should we really be sinking our money into this?
Questions that get to the bottom of things.
How much CO2 does a tree absorb anyway? Your questions.
How often do you think we should use the reusable cups to compensate for the paper ones?
But don't worry, we've got answers too. Answers to help you navigate some of the biggest environmental issues of our time. That's on Living Planet.
Find us wherever you get podcasts.
So, Michaela, what exactly is it that Friedrich Merz hopes to achieve? Can you just be specific for the Gulf region? Is it green hydrogen or what kind of deals is it? I mean, you know, perhaps to complete the picture, we have to say this was in the past not just words, right? The German government would come with preconditions and, for example, halt arms sales to Saudi Arabia over the death of the journalist or the killing of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. These things are just not happening. So specifically, what does Friedrich Merz want from the Gulf countries?
Yes, well, specifically energy diversification, that would be gas, liquefied gas, but also there is great potential here to get off the ground what the Europeans are so struggling with in their strive to become CO2 neutral, which is to have a green hydrogen. This is the region where it could be produced at scale and potentially shipped. And that kind of matches an ambition by Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, who's got his agenda 2030. Sati, who's trying to portray an innovative picture of post-petro industry that he wants to shape. So there are some matching interests here. And yes, absolutely. Looking into the past, there was much more of a moral approach to these regimes, one has to say. At the same time, it was Joe Biden, the former US president, who did cross that, what was then seen a red line of bringing MBS, Saudi Arabia's ruler, de facto ruler, back into the fold of international diplomacy. And that's that really allowed for his US allies to start talking to him again. So it's not kind of the shock moment that it would have been in the past. I've been trying to extract from the delegation here in which shape or form human rights were raised. And all I'm getting is kind of a hard sell of that Germany does raise these issues when appropriate. So we're probably not going to learn ever what was said in that one-on-one meeting. It certainly doesn't appear to have been part of a bigger conversation. But clearly, I'm seeing a chancellor here who's being very realistic about Germany's, about Europe's energy dependency. And he's also confident, though, that the Europeans have something that the Gulf states want. And that is actually not just defense goods. There, they seem to have missed the boat on a couple of issues, particularly on those fighter jets that the Saudis are now probably going to buy from the United States. That's how it looks at the moment, because the Europeans had hesitated so long on the Eurofighter. But the reliability itself is a currency. And also, Germany in particular seems to be giving ground and getting more realistic that it may have to go along with the demands of Qatar, for instance, to have much longer term, 20-year and beyond contracts for imports of gas. And that's all something Germany in the past administration, I'd say until, you know, even when Merz came into office, was very reluctant to do, because they were banking on much more short-term contracts and the hope to get out of fossil fuels a lot quicker. So it looks like these interests are coinciding here. But as a reporter, I also want to say, you know, it is quite tricky when you're part of the traveling press and you are only allocated spots where you're allowed to stand and record something for in countries that are presenting themselves, particularly Saudi Arabia, as now much more open, that are having raves in the desert. And there is a huge clash there.
You mean rather than being able to ask questions? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Well, there wasn't even statements in Saudi Arabia. We didn't even have both leaders give a statement. We did not even have the German Chancellor on Saudi soil give a statement to his own press. That happened in Germany before departure. Here in Qatar, we understand that we will get at least a mini press conference from Friedrich Merz. We were inside the room when the introductory speeches between him and the Prime Minister were given during a business dialogue. But in terms of actually being close to any political interaction, it simply is not happening. And that is something that was also always tricky in the past, but that is a fact of life here in trying to cover what are really key contracts and what really is a key development in terms of Germany orienting itself elsewhere in the world away from the US.
Yeah, and I guess that's also part of the new reality, but it's not true for, I believe, for Richard's trip, right? Richard, you can ask questions. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, the countries that Johan Vadeful has visited this week? You've been on the road since Sunday, so for 4 days, essentially.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, we have had more opportunities to ask questions than Michaela. We've also, I mean, it's been a kind of a head-spinning journey recently. I mean, just to kind of give you a sense that, I mean, these political, I mean, you guys have been on these before. You know, they're often, you know, extremely intense. You know, you go into a lot of places in a short time, but I think this one is probably takes the biscuit. So we flew on the first night to Singapore, then we had a few hours on the ground in Singapore, then we flew a second night to Auckland in New Zealand, then we had like half a day in New Zealand, including a domestic flight to the north of the country. Then we flew from there to Tonga, so a Pacific island state, so very close to the international dateline, so almost as far as you can get from Germany. Then we flew back to Auckland and then to Canberra in Australia, and then today on to Brunei. And the measure of this trip is that our flight today from Canberra to Brunei felt really short, but it was 7 hours, you know. So and I guess, I mean, I, you know, talking to various people that we've met on this trip, you know, I tell them that trip, and my goodness, and it's effectively amounted to doing a day trip to New Zealand, which I never thought I would say I've done in my life. But that's the reality, I think, when you want to. I mean, Germany's very interested in building ties with the Indo-Pacific region. Johann Vattenfall, the foreign minister, is clearly making this, you know, a strong emphasis of his period in office. This is his fourth trip to the region. And here, visiting these very diverse countries, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, Tonga, Brunei, I mean, there are some things kind of in common in that, you know, none of them are really big countries, yeah? Some of them you would classify as a middle power, some of them very small, like Tonga itself, only 100,000 population. But it all fits under this mantra of Germany needing to build more partnerships, build more connections in the world. We've heard from Michaela and from Jacob about, you know, the need to diversify all sorts of supplies. You know, that applies in the case of Australia, particularly to this issue of rare earths, you know, these critical minerals that industry desperately needs, and Germany is, as well as most of us, highly dependent on China for. But it's also, I think, you know, that part of what looms in the background is that Germany is applying for one of the elected seats on the UN Security Council, which comes up for election every couple of years. There's going to be an election this summer. Germany wants to have a 2-year stint from the beginning of 2027. And that requires you to kind of go out and drum up votes, you know? So that's, I think, also part of the background to this trip. And you can also see that in the context of this, you know, new world that we're entering, where you've got, you know, Donald Trump sort of very much pulling back from the United Nations, just recently pulling the US out of all sorts of different UN bodies. And you can see that he's almost trying to set up an alternative to United Nations with his peace board, which I think the Germans see as increasingly ridiculous to the point of being highly corrupt. And then the Chinese wanting to fill that void. You know, they've built up a huge amount of power within the UN system. And Germany wanting to be out there trying to kind of carry the torch for, you know, middle-sized democracies that see the world differently from both of those big players.
Jacob, yeah, how difficult is it for Germany to actually acquire knowledge of what these countries might want from Germany, what their position is? Because, you know, Germany is not used to having to deal with all these other countries around the world. It sounds naive, right?
I mean, but yeah.
It's true, right?
Tell no, it's an interesting point, and I was just going to jump in here because I think this trip, especially the Southeast Asia aspect, sort of covers it in such an interesting way, right? Sort of, but I mean, in a sense, the same applies to the Middle East trip, right? Like, I mean, sort of visiting three countries within the span of a few hours is really quite an extreme trip for the chancellor, but it speaks to the sort of reality that we're confronted with today, right? Where kind of, I mean, fundamentally German actors, certainly from the private sector, have a footprint that is kind of pretty much all across the world, but that didn't necessarily require a sort of depth of understanding of sort of local dynamics and sort of local interest politics to quite the same degree that it acquires today. And I mean, I think in the Middle Eastern context or in the Gulf state context, that is actually particularly striking. I mean, there were moments where you could perhaps sort of make the argument in the past that sort of if you visited one of these capitals, you could kind of get a read of the region and you would get a sort of reasonably substantive understanding of what different actors actually wanted from you. And that is no longer necessarily the case, right? Like, I mean, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates don't see eye to eye on many issues. They are sort of pretty outright rivals in some of the conflicts in the region and sort of very invested in those. And even in terms of the economic strategies, I mean, they might sort of have certain similarities with each other, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are particularly aligned. I mean, these countries also stand in competition with each other to a certain extent. And in that regard, sort of really understanding sort of how the world is evolving from each of these actors' perspective and kind of what opportunities and challenges that presents to us is absolutely vital. And I mean, it's sort of a bit of kind of pro domo argument, of course, for a think tanker to make, but sort of just the degree of kind of country expertise and depth of understanding that we have on many of these places in the world is just like totally insufficient, right? And this applies to large countries. I mean, if we look at the roster of genuine German India experts, it's very, very modest.
Well, we've got Same one. We've got Richard here. Maybe. Richard, is that your impression as well? When, you know, is that an issue for them that they really just have a handful of experts on all of these regions, political experts, not economic experts?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think this is something I definitely perceive in the relationship with India, that you don't in Germany have yet that kind of mass of politicians in parliament and, you know, think tankers, journalists who have a lot of experience and interest in India. It's just not really there. And of course, you have that on a huge scale with the United States. You had it also on a large scale with Russia. Increasingly, you know, a decent scale with China. Of course, that has also been a bit of an issue. But as China became more and more economically relevant to the Germany, that obviously built up. But that is definitely a gap that is waiting to be filled for India. And I think that does have an impact on Germany's interest in India and its ability to really see India as the strategic opportunity in terms of, you know, in terms of international relations and in terms of future export and business opportunities that it potentially is. And I think one thing that also strikes me about this period that we're living in, and as you guys were talking about earlier, you know, the increasing recognition in Germany and particularly in the German government that they're moving towards a time where they have to put Germany's interests first and not place quite such emphasis on values. Well, that's definitely what India's been doing all along. You know, it's been very much a realist foreign policy, and India has also had what you call a policy of multi-alignment, that they don't, you know, go for alliances, which have been the total bedrock of Germany. So I think if anything, this could be a time where Germany becomes more like India in certain ways than it has been before. And yeah, so absolutely, I think that's a good point. But just a quick thought to add to that, and I think Jacob kind of glanced at this earlier. We shouldn't overemphasize that this is suddenly Germany going from a values-based foreign policy to an interest-based one, because you certainly could not say that Germany's engagement with China in the last 20 years was values-based. It certainly wasn't. It was money, money, money that did the talking there. Likewise with Russia. I mean, it was not that, you know, Angela Merkel had some huge kind of love for Vladimir Putin's values as she signed up for Nord Stream 2 after the Russians took over Crimea. No, that was purely driven by a perception of interests, which of course then later was revealed to be a pretty shaky perception.
There is a tangible difference, though, to before. While Germany was never on a human rights crusade, we did have a Green foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, who did accuse the Chinese leader Xi Jinping of being, I think she used the word dictator even. And here in the region, I can say that there is such deep frustration with the Germans that they are working against overcoming, which is that over human rights concerns, spare parts weren't sent to enable them to use military equipment that they had previously bought from Germany. Now, there is a foreign minister from the party, the conservative CDU-CSU of Friedrich Merz, and that also shows a much more aligned picture of Germany, which clearly is trying to become more diverse in terms of where it gets its energy from, how it can create stability. And it also highlights the threefold challenge that Friedrich Merz is somehow trying to match at the moment, which is, first of all, to have an adequate response to this shock to the international system, particularly the transatlantic relationship. Then it's trying to hold the European Union together to find joint positions also on the trade agreement, for instance. Mercosur was a far stretch. It was a majority vote. But at the same time, he himself disagrees with a lot of EU policies. And here in the Gulf, he is collecting evidence for that. For instance, he is set against the delivery chain laws that the European Union wants to implement on how LNG is produced and how the emissions of meat methane gas that are allowed. That's something that interlocutors here see as totally overstretching the leverage that the Europeans have. And that's a message he's also taking back to the European Union, which he feels has come up with way too many laws and regulations and supply chain regulations that are hampering German growth and thereby also Europe's strength.
And we haven't even discussed the fact, Jacob, that, you know, as much as Germany wants to go out there and build bilateral ties, of course, issues like trade are dealt with on an EU level, and rightly so, right? I mean, this is the EU-India trade deal, for example. Michaela just mentioned Mercosur, which is going through another hoop, but will hopefully one day also be there. So, you know, how difficult is that going to be? And maybe that is something that you started at the very top of this program to say, you know, how much more does Germany need to do to align European interests?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's definitely a major challenge. I mean, generally speaking, I think we are sort of structurally facing this issue in terms of how the European Union operates in terms of economic issues on the world stage at the moment, that on the one hand, you have sort of classic trade discussions where it's very much clear that the EU is in charge. And then you have sort of the economic security discussions where it very quickly gets murky, right? I mean, the EU and the Commission has taken a very active stance on these matters and to a large extent also, I think, succeeded in kind of aligning European activities in that regard. But nevertheless, of course, there are still kind of country agendas that diverge in important ways. And I mean, like, I think we are seeing a moment where, like, there are moments of clarity in which countries sort of come to terms with the situations that they are facing, and suddenly we get movement. I mean, the EU-India trade agreement, like, more than two decades of discussions around that. And like, it's not a coincidence that kind of it was at the beginning of this year that suddenly we had a breakthrough there, right? So, like, I think these moments will focus minds, but at the same time, there are sort of powerful domestic political economy forces within European countries thinking about the powerful role of French farmers, for example. Like, these issues are not going away. And I think sort of thinking through also what these external partnerships will do to dynamics within the European Union, which countries stand to gain and lose, also which countries stand to gain and lose from levers that we might pull, like to pull more in the economic security space in order to protect ourselves against short-term economic coercion from actors. Like, all of these things have powerful distributive consequences, and we need to get much better at dealing with them and handling them. And so, yeah, there is as much work in progress in terms of making that happen within the EU as there is between sort of Germany and the EU and the outside world, I would say.
And can I just jump in with one little thing there? I mean, Jacob mentions French farmers, but also you can talk about sectors, industrial sectors, like the car makers in the German economy, which are really appear to be resisting what is seen by the current German administration as a strategically important economic security agenda of trying to reduce risks from China, this term of de-risking, and reducing the risk of overexposure to the Chinese market, overdependence on Chinese raw materials such as rare earths, and in fact, an increasing dependence on China as a technological base where they develop new models in the future. And so in Australia, just earlier today, there was a meeting between representatives of the Australian rare earth industry and the German foreign minister and his delegation. And I got to speak to a couple of the Australian side just before this. And, you know, one of them was saying to me, he was just calling out one of the car makers, which I will not specify, but just saying that this car maker, they need to stop buying rare earths in China and start buying them in, for example, well, Australia. Of course, he would say that. We're just saying that the individual car makers are not necessarily pursuing the agenda that the German government is trying to set. And I think this is going to be an interesting challenge for the Germans in the years ahead, because Germany is really quite committed to a sort of hands-off approach to companies to allow them to set their strategies, as opposed to France, which is much more interventionist. But if German companies are insisting on, well, we want to get our rare earths in China because we save a little bit of money and we've dealt with them a lot, Germany may have to come up with, you know, new ways of trying to strong arm these companies into doing something that is more kind of strategically in line with, you know, what the government perceives to be the national interest.
Yeah, and before we go, I'd like to ask Michaela for her last thoughts, you know, travelling with Friedrich Merz. You've watched him deal with all these countries abroad. So do you get the feeling that he's got a clear vision, that he's sort of, you know, he's got his priorities straight?
Well, I don't think he's lacking clarity on his CEO approach of what it takes to stabilize the German economy, because he can't do much more. And interestingly, on what Richard just said about rare earths, funnily enough, the Americans were already there. They've already secured long-term contracts with Australia for the provision of rare earths. So that kind of strategic foresight is something that Germany seems to be more developing on its feet now, and is trying to get the whole of Europe to go in that direction. But as always, political stability is made back home. And as a German citizen, it always struck me that such an economy that is so heavily reliant on exports has so little sense of where the jobs are coming from. And this whole kind of public debate on where German wealth is created, that it's created through opportunities abroad rather than through regulations at home, I think that is going to be much more of an uphill battle for Friedrich Merz, particularly with his Social Democrat coalition partner, than making a couple of energy deals here in the Gulf States, where he already actually picked up from his trade and energy minister who was here earlier in the week.
All right. Well, what we've established is that the line is stable to anywhere around the world, really, for Germany from Berlin. Symbolically speaking, there is a line there and it is stable. So thank you both very much. Get home safe. I look forward to having you back here in the studio. And of course, Jacob, thank you very much for your insights into, you know, what the German government is trying to diversify, so that there's not just Russia, China, and the Americans. Thank you very much for watching, and do come back next week. Make sure that you subscribe to our Berlin Briefing newsletter that comes out every week as well. Leave us a comment, and till next time.